Hi, I'm Gillian Russell, and this is the Personal Best Podcast, a download from the BBC. For more information, just head to our website, bbc.co.uk/Radio Scotland.
BBC Radio Scotland.
Come on, you can tell me. I won't say a word. What bad habits do you have? Swearing? Cracking your knuckles? Drinking too much coffee? Producer Richard Forbes has been finding out about the worst of our bad habits.
He flings his glasses around and then puts them down and then walks off and says, where are my glasses now? Where have I left them?
Your bad habit is using the Hoover but not putting the flex back on. You know how you coil it back on?
True.
You
never do that. Smoking?
Yeah, that's it.
Have you tried to give up?
I stopped for 6 years.
And what got you going again?
I was never so unwell,
right?
Honestly.
So you feel better on the flex?
Oh, everyone has to have a vice, so that's my vice.
She smokes. Other than that, not too bad. She can be bossy, though. That's why I'm bossy. Because I take it after her. I learn from the best.
Nobody's perfect. Nobody.
We're just together now. We haven't really known each other long enough.
So he's still perfect?
He's perfect at the moment.
Yeah, we all tend to be perfect when we haven't known each other for long enough. I do like that everyone has to have a vice, as if it's the law. Yeah, I'm gonna go with that one. I'm Gillian Russell, and on today's Personal Best, we're exploring bad habits and good habits and asking why the bad ones always seem to be so hard to break. Don't forget you can follow us on social media. Twitter and Instagram are at BBC Radio Scot, and the Facebook page is at BBC Radio Scotland. Although maybe not if your bad habit is spending too much time on your phone, which is actually one of mine. Dr. David Hamilton, author and expert on the power of mind, is with me. David, are you going to confess to the nation about any bad habits you might have?
Oh, definitely.
Go on, get it off your chest.
In the spirit of other people having to do the same thing. Yeah, well, I've had a bad habit for 40-odd years of biting my nails.
Really?
Yeah, but I have managed to break that habit. It took a great deal of effort, but I managed to break it. But it was hard. I tried umpteen times in my life and hadn't been able to stop. But I got a bit of leverage that helped. It was my dog. He had to get a leg amputated because he had cancer in the leg, and he being a dog, he didn't really realise that he was missing his leg, so he kept trying to scratch his head.
Aww.
Yeah, it was horrible. And my partner Elizabeth she's got big long nails, and she would scratch his neck, and he was so relieved. And then when Elizabeth wasn't in the house, and I tried to scratch his neck, and I couldn't because I had no nails. And literally on that day, that was the last time I bit my nails. Because it was the leverage. It was. I had to have a big enough reason that would literally break down all the ingrained habit. And that was all the leverage I needed. And I haven't bitten my nails since then.
That's amazing. And yeah, it took that to undo took, 40 years of
yeah,
habit.
But I tried so many times in the past, and not once had I lasted more than a week or a fortnight, maybe, if I was lucky.
Can you define for us what a habit actually is? We've all got them, good ones and especially bad ones, but what is a habit?
Yeah, well, if you think about it in the brain, a good analogy is, so if you wanted to walk across a wheat field, if you keep walking the same path across a wheat field, then you'll eventually wear a path. And that's what a habit's like in the brain. You actually wear a path, and in the brain it's called wiring. And so the brain lays down some wiring, and that becomes its normal. So sometimes when you think a thought or you're in a particular environment, the brain just goes to its well-worn path, the bit that it's always used to doing. It's like if you were trying to cross the wheat field, the chances are you would walk the path that's already clear rather than trying to create a whole new path. So the brain works kind of similarly. It uses up less energy by using existing pathways.
So it's like a sort of default setting.
It's a default setting. So the challenge with breaking a habit is you've literally got to wear a new path across the wheat field. And that's why sometimes it takes repetition of a new set of behaviours. And gradually, as you repeat a new set of behaviours, the old path begins to overgrow. So in the brain, the old wiring begins to unpick itself, just like a path in a wheat field, if you didn't use it anymore, would gradually overgrow. And the new path that you're walking would take precedence. That's why sometimes it can take a little bit of time to break a habit. You've got to keep working at it. And then after maybe 3, 4, 5, 6 weeks, and depending on the person, then you find that your new habit becomes a habit, or your new behaviour becomes an actual habit.
We'll come on to talk about that a bit more in a moment. But why do habits form in the first place? I'm wondering if there's generally some kind of pleasure going on as a result, especially a bad habit, because, you know, it's almost like the fact that you shouldn't be doing it makes it more attractive.
Kind of.
Or am I admitting too much here?
No, you're exactly the same as me. Do you know, I actually enjoy, well, I haven't done it for a few years now, but I really enjoyed biting my nails. There's something about the...
No, that's weird. Sorry, that is really weird.
There was something about the feeling of just biting them, even the flavour, as daft as that might sound. This is about being honest, I suppose, isn't it?
Yeah, fair enough.
But some habits become kind of pleasurable, but they often start in the first place because you're in a particular environment, and it's just maybe you do something, you know, for example, people who have stress habits, it's something that you do or you maybe did at one point where you were under a little bit of stress, and that habit gave you a tiny little bit of control.
And does your brain almost remember that the next time?
Your brain remembers it. It's like you're walking across the wheat field for the first time. Your brain remembers it. So the next time you're in a stressful environment, your brain thinks, well, what did I do last time? And that gave me a little bit of control, i.e. whatever your habit is, that's you having a tiny little bit of control or pleasure, despite how it might seem, in a stressful situation. So that's how we begin to wire these habits.
And then I suppose if we are deriving pleasure from it, even if it's only a small amount, the temptation is there again.
Absolutely. Until it becomes such a habit that it's largely unconscious. We don't even notice ourselves doing it.
For sure. Well, we've got lots more to talk about on habits shortly. But if you were listening to Personal Best back in January, you'll have heard me speaking to Rudy Fairbairns, author of The 28-Day Alcohol-Free Challenge, about changing our approach to our drinking habits. Well, I've been catching up with Rudy and also fellow guest Suzanne Lockhart. But first, here's a reminder of what happened the previous time we all spoke, when the gauntlet was thrown down. The only remaining question is, am I going to do the 28-day alcohol-free challenge? Okay, I'm going to say it on air. Yes, I am.
Excellent.
My producer has just fallen off her seat, but now I've said
it. Are
we
going to challenge Suzanne to do it as well? Because I know that both of you are going to feel so much better if you come and take this challenge. And if you are one of the first people to tell me that you aren't, then I'll happily stand aside and say that I wasn't successful with one person.
Suzanne?
Oh, I'm on the spot here. Oh, my goodness. Yes.
Excellent.
Let's go for it. Yes, why
okay,
not?
You and me both then. We'll try it. 28 days.
The book is in the post to you both.
So, Suzanne, did you manage the 28 days?
I did.
Well done, you.
I did. I know. Quite surprising.
28-day champion.
Well, I can go a bit better than that. I actually did 30 days.
I added
another. I knew I added another 2 days on at the end.
That's awesome. Congratulations to you both.
Well, thank you. How did you find it, Suzanne?
It was a challenge. I'll be really honest. I missed a few things happened. For example, I have a glass of wine with dinner almost every night. And what was happening after dinner, I was getting a real sugar craving. And I don't have a sweet tooth at all.
So was that was obviously because you were missing the sweetness from the wine?
From the glass of wine. So that was quite strange.
And that obviously surprised you. I mean, Rudy, is that something that you've heard of before, you've witnessed, experienced yourself? Is it, right?
Very, very common, absolutely. First of all, for the amount of sugar that's in the drinks to take away the actual taste of alcohol. If you really drank what it is, ethanol, you know, you wouldn't find it very pleasurable. So there's lots of sugar added. But also the way the body breaks down the alcohol turns it into sugars. And very, very common. People start swapping. And what we say early on for people is, look, it's the lesser of two evils. If you're going to have a bit of chocolate or something like that, you know, instead of the alcohol in the early days, in the first, you know, couple of weeks, fine, go for it. chocolate.
Because it's something to replace it with.
Yes.
Yeah, I think my chocolate intake probably increased during the time. So that was something you obviously noticed that you were quite surprised about, Suzanne.
I wasn't expecting that because I've never had a sweet tooth, but it was a real craving. It was like, oh, what have we got? And we you know, opening the cupboards. We generally don't buy biscuits and lots of sweeties, and we don't have these things in the house. So it was, yes, it was very surprising. I also do most of my writing in the evening when it's quieter, and you know, that's when I can focus more. And that glass of wine that I usually have with dinner, I normally have another wee glass of wine later in the evening when I'm writing, and I really missed that. And
that's
a lot of researchers and writers do enjoy a wee drink, and I really, really missed it then. And the other time when I was missing, I do what I call binge cooking at the weekend, cooking from scratch, so that we've got food prepared for during the week. And I use wine in cooking, and I'll have a glass of wine while I'm cooking and catching up on a movie or TV shows. That I missed that as well. So that was the two big things for me, was not being able to have a glass of wine when I'm sitting writing and researching, and not having the glass of wine while I was cooking, because that's my little reward for working so hard.
Well, it shows how much is habit, because I think that's what I learned as well, is where you're drinking at certain times, and how much of that is habit. So it's maybe you don't have a drink during the week, but at 5:30 or 6 o'clock on a Friday, you think, oh, is it about time for a drink? Or you go out for a meal and you go to the bar first and you have a drink. And it certainly opened my eyes as to my drinking habits and how much was habit, because you're almost doing it without thinking. Is that is that what a lot of people find, Rudy?
Yeah, absolutely. It's so habitual, and it takes a break to really get that awareness. And it's like any bad habit, that once you take a break from it, you start to see it for what it really is. And I think the really important thing is, this is not about deprivation from something you love. What we need to do is find the things for you to replace. So in Suzanne's case, you know, and it's very, very common with artists and writers and people like that, they feel like they get to their creativity once they loosen up.
Radio presenters, yeah.
We need it. Well, what's really going on is that you're looking to try and calm down the brain. You're looking to try and calm down that the reactions to the brain, the constant noise, so that you can get to that creative part. And alcohol does that really successfully. It does it very quickly. But there are other ways, and that's by using meditation and mindfulness, you know, perhaps yoga. These things help to calm down the brain, help you to get into a calmer state, feel more centered. And so those would be the things that I would be trying to introduce instead of that craving for the wine afterwards. It takes practice. It's not an instant fix like alcohol, but the long-term result is that you're getting to a more authentic place. That would be the hope.
All right, we might need to try that the next time, Suzanne. what about benefits, Suzanne? Did you notice anything? Like, did you lose any weight, for example?
I didn't lose. I tell you, I saved money in taxis.
Ah, that's interesting, because you were able to drive. Yes, I was a driver for a month. Yeah,
that was a plus point. I didn't notice any significant benefit pertaining to weight loss or how I was feeling in the morning.
You didn't lose any weight. I did. I lost 3 pounds.
Awesome.
Yeah, because I did. I made sure I weighed myself at the start and at the end, so that was good. I think I'd probably save pounds in terms of money as well, like you said. It does actually make you open your eyes as to when you have a drink, you know, and how big a part of your sort of social situation it might be. I mean, talking about social situations, Suzanne, how did you get on with those?
Well, I tended to go for lunch more often than going for dinner, and because I would have sparkling water with lunch and I would drive. And I probably did choose lunch because of not drinking alcohol.
So you could slightly avoid the...
So that I could avoid the temptation and also seeing everyone enjoying themselves, drinking a nice glass of Chablis or whatever.
It can be hard. I know. I had quite a lot of social occasions on during that period. And I did go to the mall. A meal out with friends, family round for dinner, a curry night. And the ultimate challenge was a rugby club burn supper, which I managed without, succumbing.
Without anything.
But I actually found people are supportive, because I think if you tell people you're actually doing a challenge, and there's lots of these kind of challenges around nowadays, actually nobody was saying, oh, go on, have a drink. They were all actually quite interested and supportive of the challenge being done, sort of thing.
Brilliant.
Just before I let you both go, throughout the programme, we're also talking about other habits that we might want to knock on the head, other bad habits especially. Anything else either of you two would quite like to give up or challenge yourself?
I'm perfect.
Not at all. Nail biting, that's one that has always definitely got on top of me. And procrastinating, how about that?
Yes, procrastinating would be mine as well.
I'm
when
the
it comes
chief
to
of that, I think.
Admin, paperwork, you know, things like that,
Right, okay. Yeah. That's your challenge, you two. I expect you to report back.
So we'll meet again in a month from now after we've done the 28-day no procrastination challenge.
And no nail biting. Your nails will be really long by then.
I don't know how much stuff I would get done if I didn't procrastinate. It'll just be amazing.
Yeah, procrastination is definitely another one of mine. So that's three I've admitted to, because drinking as well. And nail biters, Dr. David Hamilton, there's more. Another nail biter. You're not alone.
I'm not alone. I feel better now.
Now, just listening back to that about drinking habits, you know, it's interesting that so much of it seems to be habit. And there's almost that automatic association with perhaps when we have a drink. So we might have it when we're cooking or when we go out for a meal or that Friday night thing. What's going on in our brains there? Because it's almost, again, going back to that default setting that you associate a drink with certain situations.
Yeah, again, it's like you said, it's association. So what happens, the way memory kind of works actually in the brain is you tend to remember things that are associated with other things. So if, for example, you were in a particular room and something happened, then the next time you were in that room, you would probably remember what happened the last time. So we make associations between situations and events. So when you go into a social situation and it's the habit, because in the brain suddenly, as if the brain was talking to you, saying, oh, what you normally do here is you have a drink. And we derive some sort of pleasure and kind of balance out of doing the same things that we've always done. And that's why it's so difficult at first, because it seems so strange. What else can I possibly do? You can't even think of anything else to do because this is what you've always done. It's like such a well-worn track in the brain. One of the things I find that helps with breaking habits is understanding that it can be done. Some research suggests that can happen in 21 days. Other research suggests it takes maybe 2.5 months. And I think it depends on the individual. It depends on the habit. But the point is, if you understand it can be done, and if you think of it in terms of in this kind of way, like wiring in the brain, I've noticed that it motivates people to be willing to try.
Yes, yeah. And even, well, trying that 28-day alcohol-free challenge, hearing that other people had done it, and I thought, right, I'll give it a go, because if they can do it, surely I can, sort of thing. Yeah. And that is sort of quite encouraging to realise that, yes, it is possible. And it does open your eyes to whatever habit you're breaking when you set yourself that challenge. Yeah. And I suppose most of them can be broken.
and you know, on a positive note, you can actually on purpose wire in a positive habit for no reason at all other than you want to. For example, I often set people a 21-day kindness challenge, meaning they've got to do an act of kindness every day for 21 days. Mm. And the reason why the 21 days is because that's roughly, on average, how long it takes for something to become a habit if you put a little bit of practice into it. And then so you're wiring in a positive set of behaviours.
And I wonder if the more of those we do, the more we might push out the bad habits. Because there wouldn't be room for them.
Absolutely, by accident, so to speak.
You're listening to Personal Best on BBC Radio Scotland with me, Gillian Russell. Now, if a habit gets more serious and starts to take over your life, whether that's sugar, shopping or social media, what would you do to break the cycle? Jo DeRosa has been there herself, and through her own experiences, she's now developed Quantum Sobriety, a novel approach to challenging what you might be addicted to. Well, when I caught up with Jo, I asked her to explain what exactly quantum sobriety is.
It's basically a joining of spirituality and science, and meditation is a bridge between those two things. And a lot of the meditations that we use in the program are quite practical, and they're journeys that we take within ourselves. And then the science, the quantum physics of the fact that anything is possible, the pure potentiality that is all around us, is where the quantum part of quantum sobriety comes in. So it's describing how we have got choice in absolutely everything. We are choosing moment to moment, second to second, minute to minute, day to day. We're choosing our reality. We're choosing the kind of life that we want. And really, my job is to give permission for people to do that.
Well, we sent Simon Preston along to one of your recent events in Edinburgh to find out from some of the people there about why they decided to give this approach a go.
I think it's a bit different to other things in the sense that, especially amongst the group, there is no judgment. I think added to that is the meditation side of it, which, you know, we all know is beneficial on so many levels. So the spiritual side of it, I think, is very appealing and for me, a very important part of it.
What is it about this approach that really grabs you, that makes you think this is something that could work with you?
The word quantum appeals to me. I don't know why. Yeah. Nobody really knows what it means, do they? But
I'm curious, so just find out something about it, just some little things. I mean, I'm not sure, little tricks I can use in my life and improve my day-to-day life.
But I guess if you're mentally somewhere, it's hard to picture being somewhere else. Where you have to have faith, I guess. Does that make sense or no?
The kind of like-minded community, and the fact that I think it is just really the no guilt, no shame kind of thing that spurs people on. And I think being among people who are going through the same as you, and also people who've gone through that journey and come out of it successfully, which is very inspiring to hear about.
Oh, some interesting responses there, Joe. I mean, how does it actually work for people?
It works for anything that's out of balance, because the meditations are guiding you to your truth, to your heart, to your it's a journey out of your head and the craziness and the overwhelm that we often feel from responsibilities, from expectations of others, from family, from our job, and we can feel, and I think in this day and age with social media, we can be addicted to social media as well. There's so much overwhelm, there's so much stimulation, and that feels very overwhelming for people. So what this program does, and what the meditations are formed to do, is to drop out of our heads and to find some space. So you're finding your balance. We're teaching you how to find your balance, and therefore you can then find what is balanced in your work life, what is balanced in your health and your food, what's balanced with alcohol, drugs, with relationships, finding love. I mean, we really do work with everything, basically. I mean, it seems really broad, but
well, I was going to say, so it's, I mean, it's not just drink and drugs. It could be, you said, relationships there, food, social media addiction.
Yes.
Anything like that that feels out of kilter in your life.
It's anything that's out of balance. It's we're showing you how to get back into balance. So therefore, it works for everything. And very much what I've done in my experience, I started off with the very destructive, gross substances like alcohol, like cocaine, like smoking. And then once I had those, I'd got those in balance. I mean, I'd got rid of them completely. I then started to work with food addiction, and food addiction is very difficult because you still have to eat. It's with alcohol and drugs, you can say, right, that's it, I'm not smoking anymore, I'm not drinking anymore, and you can actually cease those behaviours completely, 100%. But with something like food addiction or sex addiction or sugar addiction, you still have to eat. It's still nice to have sex, but to find these and to bring these into balance is actually more difficult. So I think that society sees these things as perhaps not as major, but they're slightly more difficult to get into balance, because you do still have them in life. You have got to eat, after all.
Are we talking here lifelong change and the sort of feeling that, well, we need to keep it up if it's going to work?
Once you get to a place within your meditation where you understand who you are, that is lifelong, that is unchanging. You realise that actually living like this is so much fuller, I'm so much happier, I'm so much more content. Everything in my life is running smoothly. I'm more in flow, and even when bad stuff happens, I don't need to reach for something that is harming me. I've got the tools to look after myself. I know what to do. I know how to get myself back on track.
Dr. David Hamilton was listening to that with me. David, Jo refers to quantum in her approach. Now, apart from using the word alongside the word physics, quantum physics, what does it actually mean in the therapeutic context?
There's a few different contexts. You know, quantum quite literally means the smallest measurable unit, but people tend to associate it with the idea that anything is actually possible. You know, so in a therapeutic setting, people use it largely meaning that you are capable of more than you think. There are more opportunities and possibilities open to you. So in other words, I can choose to go in this whole new healthy direction rather than this unhealthy direction. So that's the context that in a therapeutic setting people often use it.
And it's, I suppose it's giving whatever it is you're doing a very positive spin.
Yeah.
It's a
can-do attitude. For a lot of people, I heard the lady saying she likes the word, the sound of the word. And I think just culturally we've got a positive association with that word. And I think it comes from that idea that you're capable of more than we normally think we might be able to be.
Well, with that in mind, and just finally, David, we've been talking throughout the programme about habits, and especially bad habits. What practical tips might you have for breaking a bad habit that we can take away and try today, now?
One thing for a start is leverage. You can make a little note. This is a simple exercise when you can write down, you know, what might the consequences be if I don't break this habit. If I keep going the way I am, what might the consequences be for your health, your happiness, your job, your finances, your family, the people that you interact with? And then you put another little column and you say, what might the consequences be if I do choose to break this habit from this moment forward? What might the consequences be for my health, my happiness, my finances, my career? You know, what potential could there be if I was able to break this habit further down the line, even for my relationships? And what you're looking for is leverage. You're looking for it to be better. Clearly, on paper, if you write it down, you're looking for it to be better if you break the habit right now. So that leverage actually gives a lot of people that energy that they need, because the hardest thing really is to actually make a start. So having that leverage gives you a reason for doing it.
I like that. I think we should all go away and try that.
Yeah.
Thank you for that, David. We are right out of time. A big thanks to my guests, David, Jo, Suzanne and Rudy. Don't forget, if you've missed anything at all, you can catch up on the BBC iPlayer or download our free podcast. Next week, we're all about feet. Yes, really, feet. Now, I don't particularly like feet and I've no idea how I'm going to get through that programme, but more of that next week. I'll leave you with that thought, but in the meantime, don't disappear. There's lots more to come here on BBC Radio Scotland.